Welcome to The Medical Maze. I'm your host, Donellen Ray, and today we're going to be talking about inclusion body myositis with our special guest, Jim Matthews. But first, let's say hello to my co-host, Phil.
Hey, good afternoon, good morning, good evening, whatever time you're watching the show. Donellen, this is something that I have never heard of. So for those who are watching, this is something brand new we're bringing to you. So I'm going to learn something today, so I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, this is something that I just became aware of recently. An acquaintance was diagnosed with this, and I just really didn't know anything about it. So I just thought it was a really good and interesting topic to talk about. And I'm so glad that Jim Matthews has agreed to come and speak to us about it, because I believe he is a sufferer with this, as well as being he can correct me when he gets on here, the president of the Myositis Foundation, I believe. Hello, Jim. Thank you for joining us.
Hello. And you had it close, but not quite.
Close? Okay.
I was the chairman of the board of the Myositis Association.
Ah, yes. Okay.
I termed off the board back in January, but spent 6 years on that board.
Great, great. So yes, the association. So for those that maybe want a resource link, please go and look at that. But Jim, first off, let's talk about what is inclusion body myositis. Myositis itself is what, muscle inflammation and weakness? Is that true?
Yeah, you break the word apart. Myo means muscle, and itis is inflammation. So technically inflammation of the muscle.
Okay, so what is special about this inclusion body myositis?
It gets its name from the fact that what I call rogue proteins, tangled tau fibers, amyloid plaque, invade muscle cells and eventually kill them. It's a slower process, but that's how it gets its name. There are those inclusion bodies. When you look at the muscle cells that are affected under an electron microscope, that's what you see.
Okay. And how long have you had this, or how long since you were diagnosed?
Well, I was diagnosed about 8 years ago, but I'm unusual in the fact that I know when this process started. It started in 2005 when I went to my doctor for an annual physical, and he told me that my liver enzymes were slightly elevated. Now, his advice was cut back on your drinking, which really wasn't unusual. He and I went to pharmacy school together. He went on to become a physician. Knowing me back in college, it might have been a fair assumption, but I'm not a drinker, really. One or two alcoholic beverages a week is about it.
So nothing that you think that should have affected your liver in such a manner. So
no, exactly not.
So that started back in 2005, and it took you until about 8 years ago to go and be
about 5 years later, I started noticing physical symptoms, but I wrote them off to, I was an athlete. I've had multiple knee operations for athletic misendeavors. So I thought, okay, I'm getting older and I've got bad knees, and that's why I don't move around as fast as I used to.
And so what are some of those symptoms? So you're saying that moving maybe not as agile as you used to be. So what are some other symptoms of this?
Most people start to trip or stumble. I didn't have too much of that. I did fall a couple times. I was a collegiate tennis player and played competitive tennis up until fairly recently. And I would stumble on the court once in a while. I fell a couple times, but I just thought I needed to get into the gym and, get my muscles a little stronger. So people notice tripping, stumbling, having difficulty walking upstairs in particular. Most people toward the end of their disease anyway, will have difficulty swallowing. So with some people, that's the first thing they notice. Grip strength, dropping things. You see my hand, but it, I can't make a good fist anymore. And that's actually what happened when I went to a new doctor and told him I couldn't make a fist anymore. He sent me to a neurologist. After 9 tubes of blood, manual muscle testing, and then ordered 2 tests, an EMG, which is an electromyograph, so it tests the muscle, and nerve conduction studies, where they put like a little taser on a nerve and then see what jumps. And if it jumps good, your nerves are working.
Okay.
But the EMG was what gave them a clue that this was a muscle disease, unlike ALS, which is a nerve disease.
Okay, because it's interesting, because the acquaintance I had mentioned who ended up with this, he was diagnosed with ALS, and I think sounds like that may be a common misdiagnosis.
Fairly common. I did a survey once, certainly not scientific, but talked to about 10 or about 100 people on a support group, and about 20% of them were misdiagnosed to begin with, and about 25% of those were misdiagnosed with ALS. And that's scary.
That is scary. That's exactly what went through my mind, because my understanding is that the prognosis for these are very different, whereas ALS is more of a terminal. And I believe that IBM, if I'm understanding my research correctly, is that it doesn't necessarily shorten your lifespan. I mean, you may have these falls that you mentioned. Maybe someone gets hurt from a fall, but it doesn't necessarily shorten your lifespan. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. And it's a common statement that you will die with IBM, not from IBM.
Okay.
Now, it can shorten your life, and they're starting to see that a little. People with IBM and the difficulty swallowing sometimes have aspiration pneumonia.
Okay.
And that can be, that obviously is a serious disease.
So is this hard to diagnose, since it seems that they may be diagnosed with ALS first or something else? Is IBM hard to diagnose?
Not by somebody who really knows what they're looking for, but unfortunately there aren't. And this is, I say this, and it isn't bragging, but I know more about IBM than 98 or 99% of all the physicians in the world. They just don't see it. It's rare, so they don't come across it. More unfortunate is that I may know more about IBM than half of the specialists, and those usually are neurologists and rheumatologists are the people that would treat this.
But Jim, don't you think that's a bad thing, though? Because how do you communicate with the doctor when you know more than them?
Well, I know that, and thank God, there are a number of doctors who are far more knowledgeable than I. Those are the specialists. There's certain myositis centers around the country, actually around the world. But, you know, Johns Hopkins, the Mayo Clinic, there's a Washington University in St. Louis. And there are these different centers, and I'm going to get in trouble because I probably didn't give a couple that should have been given, but there are people who specialize in this. And if you get to one of them, the diagnosis is really not that hard.
Gosh, but say you're in maybe a smaller town or something, and you go to a doctor, and do a lot of the patients find themselves educating those doctors in order to try to get a proper diagnosis, because you can't be treated until you get a proper diagnosis. So,
well, and there are resources. I mentioned the Myositis Association early on, and there's another one called Myositis Support and Understanding that does very good work too. And they put out literature that you can take to your doctor.
Oh, good.
And educate them. But you really, to be treated right, you really need to get to a myositis specialist. And they're, you know, they're around the country. It's not that there aren't any, but lots of times I lucked out. My doctor said, I'm going to send you to a neurologist.
Okay.
And, you know, is there anyone that you want to go to? And I said, no, you know, send me to Grand Rapids. Grand Rapids is a bigger city. It's 30 miles away. And I said, I'll just, you know, tell me who I go to. And I went and I got potluck. And my neurologist there, like I said, diagnosed me on my second visit. That's extremely fast.
I was going to say, that's not what happened to the acquaintance I know. It took a lot of tests, a lot of doctors, a lot of different people. And it, and again, ALS was the first one. And so imagine what that does to you mentally, to the patient and the families. And then to go and say, okay, well, let's go do some more tests and then finally get this diagnosis. So that is very, very fortunate that on your, what was it, second visit you said?
Second visit, to this particular neurologist, and she walked in the room when I was just finishing up my EMG, electromyograph, which is interesting because it's kind of like an EKG, mm-hmm. but it there is no distinct pattern like an EKG, you know, that goes up and down with your heartbeat. This is just on an oscilloscope, it's just static. And that they pipe it to a speaker, so you hear the static, and that's the myotonic peaks and whatever's with your muscles. So she walked in the room and listened more than watched, and said, "I think you have inclusion body myositis."
Wow.
To which I said, "What's that?"
Yeah. What? Yeah.
Yeah. I even said, you know, no offense, but spell it for me, please, because you know I'm going to Google it as soon as I get out of your office.
That's what I do. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a shame that that's kind of where you got to learn a lot of these things initially, if it's not a real, like you said, it's rare. And how many people do you think, if it's rare, many people do you think about it?
The numbers I use are between 20 and 25,000 people in the United States. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously more in the world, and there are pockets of it which nobody can quite explain, but in different areas of the world.
Right.
Southwestern Australia, I know in the Netherlands it is more common, and we're not talking like common, we're just talking about more common,
right? And so you don't know what brings it on. So
no, that's the, you know, that's the $64,000 question, is what causes this to happen. And there are theories. Again, my favorite is that somehow we are genetically predisposed to it. And then some environmental trigger sets it off. But that's just a slightly educated guess.
So as far as you know, there's not necessarily a genetic basis for it. Maybe there could be, but you don't know it in your case.
No, and there is such a thing as hereditary IBM.
Okay.
And it's not the same. What I have and what most of us have is called sporadic inclusion body myositis.
Okay.
Which means it just happens. And there's no rhythm or rhyme to it.
Mm-hmm.
There is a hereditary form, and even more rare than that, there are there is a familial form, FIBM, and nobody can figure out why that is, but in rare cases, and I mean rare, it runs in a family.
Wow.
No explanation for why that would be.
Yeah, and it sounds like you were very active, so you were a very healthy individual. So, yeah, you don't know what it was in order not to have it happen again. And is this something? Is this something that can get worse but can get better, or is it just more of a gradual, and then you try to have it not get worse?
It really is a gradual decline.
Okay.
And there is no such thing as a flare or remission.
Okay.
It doesn't happen in IBM. You can have good days and bad days. You can have days where you feel really good and you think, wow, this is, you know, I'm better today, but it's just the day.
Okay. Okay. So long term, though, so you said it's a gradual. So is there a way to, I know that in my research, I didn't see where there were a lot of treatments other than, say, like a physical therapy, some occupational therapy. I don't know that there's medication for it. So is this something that just eventually, I mean, you can hold off by doing all those therapies at all?
You can
slow
things down, but you can't stop it. At least no one's figured that out. There have been a number of clinical trials. I was in one of them a couple of years ago on a drug that showed a little promise. But we had 150 people in this clinical trial. And it, in the end, it just didn't really show improvement. The placebo group and the group of people who got the drug, there was really no significant difference between the two.
Oh, really? Okay. So they are doing some research. They're trying to find some treatments.
There are, and there are a couple new ones. Normally in these clinical trials, you have to qualify to get into them. And they're looking for people that are not so far gone that they'll be able to see progress. There's one out right now. The drug is called ABC-008. The main doctor is Dr. Steven Greenberg out of the Boston area. Mm-hmm. And they're starting to have sites around the country, around the globe, really. And I don't qualify anymore. One of the things that I can't do that you have to be able to is rise from a standard chair with arms, walk 10 meters, turn around, come back and sit down. And I can't get up from a chair like that anymore.
Well, yeah, because my understanding was if it does affect all of that, that would seem pretty hard to do for someone that is, and are you considered, and if this is such a classification, moderate? Or are you advanced?
No, I would consider moderate. There actually is a scale. They call it the IBM FRS. FRS stands for Functional Rating Scale.
Okay.
It's a 40-point scale, 10 questions, each one with a weight of 4 points. So if you're perfect, you score 40 on it. When I was diagnosed, I think my score was 37 or 38.
Okay.
My score now is 21.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, and there are people, there's a guy that I know, and he started breaking it down into half points because he says, I'm now 1 3/4 on that scale. He's very far along and he is what I would call a functional quadriplegic.
Oh, wow. Okay. So he's very advanced. And it he's can very go that advanced. And it goes that far. What is the kind of advanced stage look like? So like you're saying quadriplegic, so you're talking wheelchair, and does he have the swallowing issue?
You know, I don't know. He must have the swallowing issue where he wouldn't have scored that low, but I have never talked to him about that. No, he's completely dependent on his wife, who's his caretaker, a lot of devices that he uses to help. He does a video series, and actually it's pretty good. It's a little hokey, but it's good information.
Okay.
And he tells people, you know, if you need a hospital bed, now here's some ones I recommend. If you need a ramped minivan, I'm now spend most of my time in my chair or transferring to another seat. Most of my time sitting down.
Okay.
And I had to buy a minivan with a ramp that I could pull up, you know, drive into with my chair.
Okay.
I can still drive. My legs and my arms are good enough, and that I feel safe. My wife will tell me when she thinks I'm not.
Oh, okay. Okay. So you didn't have to modify your, you know, adapt your driving or anything, your steering or your.
No, I still, you know, and people ask, you know, do you use hand controls? No, I don't have to yet. And actually, because my arms, my hands will deteriorate at the same time that my legs deteriorate, I think I won't ever be able to use hand controls. That won't help me. When I can't drive any longer, and I don't know how long that is, but it could be within the next year. And then I become a permanent passenger.
Oh, okay. So yours deteriorates at the same time, your arms and your legs. Is that common for others?
I think so. I think so. Most people do. Again, quadriceps, the anterior tib, which is your shin muscles on the lower extremity go, and it's finger flexors. It's basically your forearms. I'm not going to thrill you by showing you how I look like an emaciated man from my elbows down. And
oh, really?
Because
okay.
that's the finger flexors that go. I know one person that has had a tendon transfer. And I'm kind of following her to see she actually can pick up things that she couldn't before.
Really?
That's a major surgery. It's a long recovery period. I don't know if I would personally choose to go through that.
I've never heard of something like that. So, I mean, I get it. They transfer the tendon, and then that way, is there any... I guess you don't know. Maybe she doesn't know. Is there the chance that that will also go and get it as well?
It probably will. It will allow her to be more functional. And that's why I'm kind of following her, just to see how long does this work? I mean, so the question in my mind for me is, how much trouble do I want to go through to just turn back the clock for a year? If it's a year, and I mean, I'm guessing, but
yeah, however long that is,
yeah. Well,
and then,
is it worth it to go through that trouble to gain that little function if it's going to go away again somewhere down the road?
Oh man, that's a hard thing to talk about.
Yeah, and
it's a hard decision.
Well, and I'm thinking too, because if you do that, and say one of these environmental factors happens, and because I'm not sure we know what it are. I think there's some suspicions on, or guesses, some people think, schools of thought, maybe is a better word, on maybe viruses causing it. And I'm just trying to look at my notes here. Maybe some drug interactions, autoimmune, possibly.
Yeah, I'll put the chart up there.
Yeah, there we go. So if one of these things happens, then does she kind of go back to square one again?
I doubt that she'd go back to square one, but she might lose what she gained by having this tendon transfer surgery.
Okay.
And then how long? The tendon transfer surgery she's telling me and others that, you know, it is helping her with her grip. She can pick things up now, a coffee mug. that she couldn't pick up before. So, you know, she's seen improvement, but what she doesn't know yet and what I don't know is how long will that improvement last? Mm-hmm. Or does she just, like I say, set the clock back a year and then a year from now she'll be back where she was before the surgery? I don't know. I'm interested in finding out.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, if it's a treatment that maybe somebody wants to try, and I assume that if maybe they'll look at the legs next. I mean, if they're doing it on the arms, can they look at trying in the legs next?
Yeah. Again, I'm not a medical expert. I'm educated in this disease.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm not a neurologist. I'm not a rheumatologist. I'm not a any kind of a medical doctor. The TMA is the Myositis Association. That's the abbreviation. So TMA has a medical advisory board of about 25 of the world's leading experts. If you pull up scientific papers on inclusion body myositis, I will almost guarantee you that if you read who the authors are of that study or that paper, at least one or two or more of them will be members of the medical advisory board of the Myositis Association. They're that good.
And oh, that's good.
Of course,
that's
I thank God for people like that. The hope is someday we'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. And it won't be me that figures it out. It'll be one of them.
Yeah. Do you know how long, speaking of one day, how long has this been around?
It was first, it's probably been around forever, but right. It was first separately diagnosed, I think, in the 70s, mid-70s.
Okay.
And at first, they thought that there are other myositises. The other main ones are polymyositis and dermatomyositis. Dermato has a dermatological thing. It usually has a rash, and that's what differentiates it. But originally, they just thought this was medication-resistant polymyositis. Because you can treat polymyositis and have positive outcomes. It's not a fun disease either, but you can treat it. You can get better. It can go into remission, which IBM can't. So they had this subset of people that they thought had polymyositis, and they treated them with immunosuppressive drugs because it's considered to be an autoimmune disease.
Okay.
And it didn't work. They couldn't figure out why this doesn't work. So now it's recognized as a separate disease.
Okay. Yeah, and this one, there's no autoimmune factor to this one either. There's nothing that indicates that at all. And it doesn't go into remission, like you said. So besides having, saying the tendon transplant or surgery, then other treatments that we briefly mentioned, like some occupational therapy, physical therapy, are those the standard protocols for it?
Yeah, and really what it does, exercise in particular. Now, you have to be careful. One of my bad falls was when I overdid exercise and my legs were kind of like mush. Mm. And I went down a curb cut, just a very gentle grade. I used to reward myself for my exercise by going to get a bucket of free popcorn at a local gas station and a Diet Coke. And
sounds
I was
like
carrying
a good treat.
It was a good treat. I still do it, even though I don't deserve the reward so much anymore. But I walked down this little thing after a hard workout, and my knees collapsed, and popcorn bucket went one way and the drink went the other way, and people were around me instantly, you know, are you okay, and you know, they got me back up to, once I figured out I was hadn't broken anything, scraped
a few
things.
Goodness.
They helped me up and got me back to my car. But appropriate exercise, and what it does is not all of your muscles are affected at once. So what exercise does is it helps to strengthen, or maybe the better word is tone, the muscles that aren't affected yet. And
okay.
You can even show a short-term improvement because you're a little stronger because you've built up those muscles that haven't been affected. But eventually, the disease catches up with you again. And I had that experience. 9 months after I was diagnosed, I went back and they said, you're a little stronger than you were when we diagnosed you. Hmm. Well, I was, but it still progressed, you know.
Well, and I thought it was interesting because you said you were playing tennis. And then you said, though, your hand is hard to grip now. So how long ago did you have to kind of, did you alter it or did you give it up?
I had to give it up, and it was more because of the falls than anything. And there is a friend of mine in the myositis community that actually made a tennis racket that you could attach. It's you put your finger through rings. Boxers or people use these things. But anyway, you attach that to the racket. Mm-hmm. You slide your fingers through
brass
it.
Knuckles? Which has to be
part.
Brass
yes, knuckles. Exactly. It looks like brass knuckles.
Okay.
And it, you know, so you attach it to that. And the thing with tennis, and what I told him was, I said, you need to do this for golfers.
Mm. Okay.
Because the same thing, and I know people who play golf, and all of a sudden they're swinging, and their golf club is going half as far as the ball went, you know. Because with a golf grip, I'm not a golfer, but as I understand it, a golf grip, you don't change that. In tennis, an experienced tennis player will change their grip, whether it's a forehand or a backhand. You rotate your hand on that. On the handle of the racket.
Mm-hmm.
And you get your fingers through these things, you really can't do that. So it's helpful.
Actually,
I was a tennis player that used what's called a continental grip. Only a few of the best tennis players, John McEnroe was one of them, Steffi Graf was another, that grip the racket the same way, whether they were hitting a forehand or a backhand.
Oh, okay.
But again, 95%, they're the exception. 95% actually rotate their hand on the racket, depending on what they're hitting, forehand or backhand.
Well, gosh, I mean, that's great. And especially since exercise seems to help, at least, like you said, tone.
Right.
It's great if they come up with some sort of adaptive way to do golf. Maybe you can come up with some sort of chair they could sit in, or tennis may be hard kind of running around, but.
While most serious tennis players kind of look down their nose at pickleball players, no offense to any pickleball player.
I wish I could play pickleball.
I wish I could. And there might be a way to, there are wheelchair tennis players. Now, most of them have had an accident and they've had a spinal injury that their upper body is good, but they're, you know, they've lost the use of their legs. And I know one in particular that lives around here. And I played some tennis with mm-hmm. her. She had a bone disease, a completely different thing, but mm-hmm. an excellent tennis player goes around the world playing in tournaments.
Oh, yeah.
But it's wheelchair tennis. It's wheelchair.
Yeah, I think it's great. And I actually, I had pickleball in mind when you mentioned it, because like I said, I'm one of those, I played pickleball. I'm not one who looks down on pickleball, but I just thought, if you could adjust it somehow, that would be great. And then people can still be active, because I can only imagine the toll this takes, certainly physically, but mentally too. I mean, you know, maybe the more active you are, maybe the better you feel mentally, because I'm sure that this is a very trying condition, because it's long-term and it's chronic and it's progressive. So I'm can only imagine whatever kind of activity or something you can to kind of give yourself that mental boost.
It's helpful. Sad to lose the things that you used to be able to do.
Yes.
I would love to get back out on a tennis court. Court. I mean, just the sound of a tennis ball hitting a racket is wonderful for me. Mm-hmm. So you mourn the loss of things that you can't do anymore, and you rejoice in the things that you can still do. That's the way, at least I and most of the people I know, that's the way we treat this. Rejoice in what you, and again, I mean, when I have to stop driving, and I will, that's going to be a huge blow for me. And I'll just have to adjust my attitude. That's all.
Well, I think that's great that, you have such a positive outlook on it. How about your family? Now you weren't misdiagnosed originally like someone with ALS, because I think hearing that, first off, for the patient is just got to be incredibly difficult, and then for your family. So how has this been? So thank goodness it doesn't sound like that happened to you, but how's this been for your family as this has kind of gone on?
I think everybody accepts it. It's fine. I've got a large family. I've got a ton of grandkids down to 6 months old.
Oh, okay.
And some of them have just grown up, the younger ones, grown up seeing me in my wheelchair.
Okay.
They want to ride.
Matter
of fact, they have the little like 3-year-olds go, I want one of those.
One of ratio, probably. Yeah.
Well, family and my wife has been incredibly supportive. I called her on my way home from that initial doctor's visit when she told me I had IBM. And I said, I'm afraid we're going to have to sell the house. We're going to have to move. Mm-hmm. We're in a 2-story house. It's not set up for a guy like me, but I have bought first a chairlift and then more recently what they call an incline platform lift that I can drive my chair onto, and then it will take me up and I can get off at the different levels of the house.
Okay.
So I can access a large portion of my house with my chair.
Okay. And this is just kind of crossed my mind. So for this adaptive equipment, is there help to get that? Is there help for, paying for that kind of stuff or adapting a home for that? I'm sorry, I'm not that familiar with that.
No, it's okay. And I'm old enough to qualify for Medicare.
Okay.
And Medicare is pretty good. Now you have to go through a bunch of hoops. You've got to get your doctor to certify that you have this disease, and then you have to get a physical therapist. Actually, I'm in the process right now. There are 3 classes of power chairs. I'm in the middle one now because it has an elevating seat. That's what makes it the middle one.
Okay.
I just started the process to get an even more bells and whistles one that's a class 3 chair. It'll take a few months. I might be able to get it, early into next year or something. I don't know exactly how long it will take, but and it's, it's just does a few more things for you, and it's got a little suspension, so it's easier on your body when you hit a bump.
That's great, because, at least there's things out there, and they're trying to make life as easy on you as possible, considering this condition that you have. So what does the long-term prognosis look like for this? I know it's gradual, so is it your friend, or can someone possibly get to a point where it just kind of levels out?
It doesn't really level up. It's a continuous process. And like I said, that 40-point scale, I'm halfway through it, but he's like at the bottom of it. And most most IBM patients, or the most common way that an IBM patient dies, and they may be well old. I mean, I had a really good friend that was, pushing 90 when he passed.
Wow, okay.
But the thing that gets more commonly is aspiration pneumonia, because you can't swallow as well as you need to.
Mm-hmm.
You aspirate, you get pneumonia. A very dear friend of mine, that's how she passed away. And I saw her. She lives down in Florida. Matter of fact, she lived on the Atlantic side, and I vacationed over by Fort Myer Beach.
Okay.
And we met on Facebook and support groups and stuff. And I said, I want to come and see you. I'll drive all the way across Florida, in the Atlantic, I think is where she was.
Oh yeah. Nice area.
And she said, well, if I'm feeling good enough, and I said, I won't drain you. I'll come over. And I called her before to make sure. And she said, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. Come on over. And we had a wonderful discussion. I kept it to an hour because I didn't want her to get tired. But she'd been in and out of the hospital with pneumonia a few times. And it wasn't but a couple months later that she passed away.
Oh,
and from the pneumonia. I mean, mentally, she was all there. I mean, we had a wonderful talk, laugh and everything. I don't know how many times she went into the hospital with pneumonia, but it was multiple times. And the one time she didn't come out.
Yeah. So it sounds like, was she the quadriplegic stage too?
She was. Okay. She was in the fancy chair, the one that I'm hoping to get.
Yeah.
But I know her husband, I still keep in contact with him. Wonderful guy. And, she lost weight toward the end. She wasn't that heavy. He was a pretty good sized guy. He could lift her up. And I don't know exactly how much he did for her, but I'm sure he was able to pick her up, put her in bed, get out. And there are other things. I think at one time in the future, I'm going to need a ceiling mounted Hoyer lift.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, it'll take me, it'll put me in bed. It'll get me out of bed, put me in my chair. It'll take me into the bathroom. It has a little turntable thing that alters the angle, and it can drop me onto a shower chair in the shower, or it can go in a little further and drop me onto the toilet. I don't need that yet. I do know some people who do, and some of that is, even if you have insurance, if you don't have a supplemental policy, Medicare will only pay for 80%.
It can get
20% of a lot of dollars is still a lot of dollars. Some people just honestly can't afford to buy that kind of equipment. I'm by no means a rich man, but I'm comfortable enough that I can do that.
Mm-hmm. Are there any organizations that you're aware of that helps people like that?
To a small degree, I mentioned Myositis Support and Understanding is another group. Mm-hmm. Now they're more about support than they are about the medical clinical trials and everything. So that's why I was with the Myositis Association. They sponsor trials, and I wanted that. But Myositis Support and Understanding is just that, support, and that includes some financial support. Now, they're not gonna pay off tens of thousands of dollars. They can. I think that like $1,500 is the most that they can give to any individual.
Okay.
So,
okay, but every little bit helps, especially if
every little bit helps, and gracious of them to be able to do that.
Well, I think that's wonderful too, and research wise, there is stuff being done, like you're saying that they're trying different surgeries, trying different research. Other ways that people could help this organization or help with this condition?
Well, I think both of the two major groups, the Myositis Association and Myositis Support and Understanding, will take donations. And and it is again with the Myositis Association, most of that funding goes to research.
Okay.
The association has given, I think, around $8 million to different research projects over the years. I don't know how much Myositis Support and Understanding has been able to raise and give out, but yeah, like I say, I'm the research guy, and actually, I'm getting to the point now where, I don't mean to make this sound morbid, I'm getting late in the stage of this that I'm really hoping out, holding out hope that a cure or a really good treatment comes out. I think it's going to be a little late for me, but there are people being diagnosed today, and we will figure something out. I'm confident of that. I just don't know how long, and I don't know if it'll be in time to be a huge benefit for me.
Yeah, I know that speaking of people diagnosed recently, we were talking about this, but this is what Peter Frampton has.
Yes.
And I know that there has been kind of some interest in the fact that he can still play guitar fairly well, because I know he's still touring at this moment, and I have seen pictures of him with a cane, so I don't know what stage, whatever the rating stage he is in, but I do know that he's been very vocal about having this.
He has, and he started a foundation. He was treated at the Johns Hopkins Myositis Center in Baltimore, and I know his physician quite well, Lisa Christopher Stein. Interesting aside, he almost always, well, the second to the last song in one of his sets is "I Don't Need No Doctor."
Oh.
An old Frampton song.
Wonder if she's listened to that.
I don't know. I think it's hilarious, though. And she's a wonderful, wonderful doctor and a great research. She's just really something. But I seen him play live twice, both after I was diagnosed. The first time was before COVID. And I watched him play, and I'm an old guitar player. I mean, not that I was anywhere in that class, but I know when somebody's playing well, and I know when somebody's not quite as good as they used to be. I can tell.
Okay.
And the first time I heard him, I couldn't tell. I couldn't tell at all. Now, the one thing that gave him away to me was he had a large mug on a table on stage. And it was like a large coffee mug. It had the grip to it.
Okay.
He would not grip it with one hand.
Oh,
and
okay.
He had to grab it with two hands to drink. And I thought, okay, no. And I could see his arms and stuff. I could see the atrophy. I may have been the only one in that crowd that even noticed that kind of stuff. Now, I saw him again this past summer. He does the whole concert now sitting down. And he needs help, whether it's a cane or I've seen one of his bandmates come up and get him, and then he'll walk off stage with his hand on that person's shoulder. But he is the poster boy for exercise.
Yeah, I think what I read was that because his fingers, I guess because he uses them so much, is why he's been able to continue playing as long as he has.
Exactly. And and guitar playing is not about strength. It's not about hand strength. It's about dexterity. And I know enough as a former guitar player to know that you can fix your guitar so that light gauge strings and the strings are close to the frets, mm-hmm. that it does not take strength. You just really have to touch that string in the right place. He's amazing. He is absolutely amazing. And it's, you know, but even he now is saying, yeah, I notice it in my playing. I can tell.
Isn't this supposed to be his farewell tour or something? I think I haven't seen
Just like most of these old rockers, you know, farewell tour number one, farewell tour number two. I think the last one, the one that he was just on, was called the Never Say Never tour.
That would probably make more sense, wouldn't it? Yeah. It and you said he has a foundation. So is his aimed at research?
Yes.
Or cure?
Absolutely.
Okay. And I guess if for folks that want to go, they could look that up at Johns Hopkins, I assume, on their website, if they wanted to go and check that out.
Yeah, I'm sure it's, I think the beneficiary is Johns Hopkins, and it is the Peter Frampton Foundation. I think he started a foundation for it.
Yeah, and I believe we were briefly talking about him being awarded, what was it, some sort of a humanitarian sort of award here recently?
The Myositis Association a couple of years ago started handing out awards. What it's called is, you know, Heroes in the Fight. Mm. And they basically have started only a couple of years ago, started handing out three awards. One to the person who does the most for publicity. That was the one he won.
Okay.
And then there's one for inspirational, and then there's one to a center that does myositis research. So it's a big gala affair, and you pay some bucks to get into it, but it's held in the conjunction with the Myositis Association's annual meeting, which again, I did not make this year. I would have loved to, because Peter Frampton wrote a book about his life and it was interesting. Mm. I don't think it's going to win a Pulitzer, but it was really interesting. And the truth of the matter is, I played with one of the people he mentions in his book.
Oh, did you really?
One night on stage with, actually, the group was called Terry Knight and the Pack at that time. They ended up becoming Grand Funk Railroad, which most people would recognize.
Now, I do know, Phil, what about you?
Yes.
Oh, okay, just checking, because, you know, we had to do a little...
I had to do a little research.
Yeah, had to do a little research on Peter Frampton with you. But yes, Grand Funk Railroad, absolutely. Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. And so you played with them.
I got up on stage with them and sang one song with them. It's an interesting story. I was some friends, high school friends. This was 1965, the year I graduated. And this guy's aunt and uncle owned a tavern up in northern Michigan, up by Traverse City. And they had little cabins to rent, and he finagled a way that we could go up and stay for free in their cabin, but we had to work in their restaurant. And the other guys had to bus tables, and I was not a very good guitar player back then, but I was good enough that they said, okay, well, you can entertain the people. And Terry Knight and the Pack happened to come into that restaurant that night. And I was playing a song that they covered. I Who Have Nothing was the name of the song. Mm. And they said, well, hey, we're playing down in Traverse City tonight. Why don't you come down and sing with us? That was it. My one shot at fame.
Hey, but you Brief. Took it. You took Brief. It.
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
Well, Jim, I tell you, this has just been fascinating. And to really kind of understand this condition, inclusion body myositis, look at the Myositis Association, not foundation, like I said, association.org. We'll have some other, we could put some other links, can't we, Phil?
Yeah, we'll put them in the actual blog post and the episode post as well.
Yeah. But thank you for spending, you know, some time this afternoon with us and educating us. And I hope that, you know, get some awareness out there, get some cure and treatment and get something that helps you guys. I don't even know what to call it. Interesting isn't a good word, but just a very unique condition. And so we thank you.
Any publicity that we can get, I mean, awareness is a huge goal of ours, because so few people know about this disease. And there are certainly other, you know, certainly other things that deserve a lot of attention. We don't get the big grant dollars for research because, you know, there are other things that will pull the heartstrings much faster. And really, I mean, if I'm going to be honest about it, you know, ALS. I have three friends, one who's already passed with ALS.
Oh, wow.
And they, you know, it's, I would never, ever trade places with them. I'm glad that if I've got to have something, I'm glad that this is what I've got.
Oh, wow, Jim. Well, thank you so much. Wow. And your story is so uplifting. I love your positive attitude. And thank you for spending some time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking.
Thank you, Jim. And so for the folks watching, if you visit our website, medicalmazepodcast.com, you'll see everything there from other episodes. Our YouTube channel is linked to it as well. Also, each episode has its individual blog attached to it. So if you want to know more, we'll put all the links in there in the description as well. So, Jim, thank you. Don Ellen, thank you. And we will catch you guys later. See ya.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you both.